B is a closed subset of x cross omega to the omega, thank you, of x cross any Polish, any uncountable Polish space. Okay, the second mistake was found by David Fremlin, and it's more serious. And the reason it's more serious is it makes one of the homework problems too easy. So last time I stated, in the term, the number I gave it last time was theorem 1.12. Pi 1.1 is closed under this kind of quantifier. Okay, that is false. So here's the correct theorem 1.12. When you apply that quantifier not to a pi 1-1 set, but to a Borel set, you get a pi 1-1 set. Okay? So if B is Borel, and we define A there exists exactly one y, b, x, y, then A is pi 1-1. Okay, so here's the picture. Here's B, here's A. This is a way to build a pi 1-1 set. Now, I used that correctly. I applied the theorem correctly, even though I didn't state it correctly. I was concerned with this particular point set in the space C01. There's exactly one x such that f is not differentiable at x. Well, this is Borel. So that requires a little argument. As a function of two variables, as a predicate of two variables, x and f, that's Borel, so when we apply this quantifier, it's pi 1-1. Okay, now one of the homework problems, which was 2C, we have to prove that the set of xn in a Banach space to the omega is weakly convergent. Is pi 1-1. And this makes it, this false theorem makes it pretty easy because you just say there's exactly one x. Xn is weakly converges to x. This is pi 1-1. Well, that's a false, that's an incorrect proof because that's a false theorem. Now, this is a true statement. This is a pi 1-1 set, the set of weakly convergent sequences in a Banach space. And it can be proved pi 1-1 without using any phony theorems. However, if you proved it this way, I can hardly hold it against you since it's my fault. So that won't count. Henrik, that doesn't count. Everybody gets full credit for that problem. And speaking of homework, I got more homework, which I'll hand out at the end of today's class. Okay, so did anybody find the third mistake? If not, we can go on. And I'm sorry to say that today will be a lot like last week. I'm going to try to cram a lot of material in, mostly without proof. And hopefully after today's class, starting next week, I'll actually have enough background to talk about equivalence relations. So the reference for today's class is Moscovakis. Almost everything is in there. And the first topic is strong axioms. Now, the axiom system, ZFC, it's good enough to prove things about the first level of the projective hierarchy. Pi 1 1, pi sigma 1 1, a little bit about the second level, almost nothing about higher levels. I think, well, we improved a little. We proved this, stated last time that there's a universal set, and you can prove that in the ZFC, and you can prove closure properties, but not much else. So let me tell you what can be proved in ZFC. First, I want to discuss regularity properties. And by regular, what I mean is that pathologies produced by the axiom of choice don't exist at this level. So an example of a pathological point set is a non-measurable set, but one would like to prove that nice sets, Borel sets, projective sets, whatever, are not measurable. So that's what I mean by regularity. Now, one example of regularity is, I mentioned, measure. Here's another. A is a point set in some Polish space X. We say A has the perfect set property. If either A is countable or A has a perfect subset. A perfect set is one which is closed with no isolated points. So this is kind of an effective way of saying A satisfies the continuum hypothesis. It implies A satisfies the continuum hypothesis. But to say A has continuum many points means there's a one-to-one function from the Cantor set into A. Saying it has a perfect set means there's a one-to-one continuous function from the Cantor set into A. It's kind of an effective continuum hypothesis. And that's a regularity property because the axiom of choice implies there are point sets without the perfect set property. So here's our first theorem. And unless other 2.1, unless I explicitly state otherwise, a theorem means a theorem of ZFC. So sigma 1-1 sets in any space are universally measurable. Have the property of bare, the category analog of measurability. And the perfect set property. And I'll actually prove this modulo, an unproved lemma. Prove the perfect set property. Now, obviously, a measurability, the complements of a measurable set's measurable, so pi 1-1 sets are measurable and have the bare property. And that's as far as you can go in ZFC. To higher levels, you need other axioms. Now, let's talk about structural properties for a moment. They're all these are just the theorems. They're not regularity. I mentioned a number of them last time, and the easiest one to state is the separation property. So that's what I'll talk about to illustrate the use of strong axioms. So by boldface gamma, a point class, to use Moskovakis' terminology, is a collection of point sets in various spaces. Okay, for example, Borel or sigma 1-1. Formally a set of ordered pairs consisting of a Polish space and a subspace. Okay, now we say a point class gamma has the separation. I'm not defining point class. A point class boldface gamma has the separation property. If any pair of disjoint gamma sets can be separated by a delta set where a set is delta if it's both gamma and gamma dual. These are complements of gamma. Oops. I want to erase that. So, for example, if this is sigma 1-1, then gamma dual pi 1-1, and this is delta 1-1, or Borel. And here's the picture. You've got two disjoint sets, which are gamma sets. I can separate it by a delta set. So in ZFC, sigma 1-1 and pi 1-2 have the separation property. And the dual classes do not. And in the sigma 1-1 case, that was theorem something or other from last time. Theorem 110. I didn't state these others last time. Okay, so that's what you can prove about regularity and this particular structural property in ZFC. Now, there's another popular axiom, known as, not popular with me, but with some people, called V equals L. And this implies, among other things, it implies there is a delta 1-2 well ordering of the reals, the usual L well ordering. So all the consequences of the axiom of choice live at the second level. Any pathology you can build using choice, you use that L well ordering, and you build it at the delta 1-2 level. And then if you're clever, maybe you can lower it to the first level. Okay, so did I number this? Theorem 2.2, V equals L implies there is a sigma 1-2 set in any space which is not Lebesgue measurable, in fact not measurable with respect to any measure, any non-point measure. And does not have the bare property. There is a pi 1-1 set violating the perfect set property. So this kind of pathology can live at level 1. And as far as the structural properties go, for n greater than or equal to 2, pi 1n has separation. Sigma 1n doesn't. I've numbered this differently in my notes, so. I'm gonna have to renumber to be consistent with my notes, otherwise I'll mess up everything. So this is theorem 2-2. And this one will become 2-3. Okay. There's another axiom called projective determinacy. Or PD. I'll define this in a moment, but before I do, let me give you the consequences. I should say something about it. This is not like V equals L. It's not equiconsistent with ZFC. It's a large cardinal axiom. As this axiom implies the consistency of ZFC, so by Gödel's second theorem, it's stronger. You can't get a relative consistency proof. But PD implies all projective sets are universally measurable have the bare property and have the perfect set property. And it implies that the circled point classes have separation. The others don't. Okay, here's the projective hierarchy. In ZFC, we prove this and this have separation. And now it keeps on oscillating, this, and this, and this, and pi 1/6. Okay. So it goes back and forth. It's a completely different pattern than what you get under V equals L. And a descriptive set theorists tend to take a different approach than toward the use of strong axioms than other set theoretic subjects like combinatorial set theory and set theory of the reals and general topology. In those other subjects that I just mentioned, people tend to prove consistency proofs. Now, there's something that you can't decide in ZFC. Well, you look for a forcing model that decides it one way and a forcing model that goes the other way. In descriptive set theory, we're more likely to just assume an axiom, either PD or perhaps a stronger determinacy axiom, start proving theorems. So it looks like ordinary mathematics. You know, there's no models, there's no forcing, there's no meta-mathematical questions involved. You just make an assumption and prove theorems. Now, in principle, one could prove things by forcing and look for consistency proofs. It's surprising how little is done in that respect. Very little known. For example, it's not known which patterns of point classes can satisfy the separation property. It's not known if this pattern here is relatively consistent with ZFC. I stated that it follows from a large cardinal axiom, but does it have consistency strength? I don't think that's known. Surely is not known. A subject like set theory of the reals is 99% forcing, and this is almost the other way around, 1% forcing. Well, maybe a little more. But when forcing is used, it's usually used to prove real theorems, as it's used in connection with absoluteness arguments to prove that something or other is true, as opposed to consistent. So we'll have very little to say about forcing. Okay, now I have to define PD. Recall from last class, if we have a subset of omega to the omega, this is a game. There's a set of reals that each player plays elements of omega. At the end of omega moves, you got an infinite sequence. If it's in, player one wins, if it's true. If it's out, player two wins. So the axiom pi 1 n determinacy for any pi 1 n set A, and it's important that this is a game on omega, not a game on the reals or higher cardinality set. For any such set A, A is determined, which means either player 1 or 2 has a winning strategy. One of the players, generally I have no idea which, but one of them has a winning strategy. Yes? No. This is the game. Yeah, they're just playing integers. The Shoke game, the Shoke game is a special case. Whenever you're playing on a countable set, you might as well be playing integers. Now, the strong Shoke game is another matter because you're playing reals or points in the space. But the ordinary Shoke game is a special case. So pi 1 1 determinacy would indeed imply that those games are determined. Okay, one could also define sigma 1 n determinacy, but they're equivalent. For any n, for any fixed n, they're equivalent. As n goes up, you get stronger and stronger and stronger axioms, even stronger in consistency strength. And PD, or projective determinacy, is for all n, pi 1 n determinacy. And for what it's worth, PD follows from omega wooden cardinals. It would take me an hour to define a wooden cardinal, so I won't. But if you know what a supercompact cardinal is, that's even stronger. In any case, there are officially recognized large cardinal axioms which tell us that PD is true. Not consistent, but true in the real world. Or not merely consistent, but true. Okay, now I promised to prove the perfect set theorem. I'll do that. I'll do a little more. But let me just say determinacy is a regularity property, like measurability, the perfect set property, but it turns out to be the strongest regularity property. If you assume this regularity property, you get all the others. So I want to demonstrate why determinacy implies the perfect set property. And just to make life easy, we'll work with 2 to the omega rather than an arbitrary space. So we have the star game, the single star game, for a set A, which is a subset of the Cantor space. Okay, and here's the game. Okay, so 1 plays SI in 2 less than omega. In other words, it plays a finite binary sequence. So one plays a finite sequence of zeros and ones of arbitrary length, and two plays a zero or one. Let's call it N. Okay, after omega moves, we get x, which is obtained by concatenating all this stuff. Okay, so you got a finite binary sequence, a zero or a one, more zeros and ones, a zero or a one. At the end, we got an infinite binary sequence, and we say one wins the round of the game. If and only if X is in the set A. Otherwise, 2 wins. Now, my next comment is very closely related to the last question that David asked me. As this is a game on a countable set, it's not literally a game on omega, but it might as well be. I mean, there's only countably many of these finite binary sequences. Okay, and if we code it up as a game on omega, it's got the same descriptive complexity. In other words, if A is, say, pi 1, 5, this will be a pi 1, 5. The corresponding game on omega will be pi 1, 5. Okay, so our determinacy axioms give us the determinacy of this sort of game. Okay, theorem 2.5a, if one has a winning strategy, A has a perfect subset, and part B, if 2 has a winning strategy, A is countable. So the determinacy of this game would imply that that set A has the perfect set property. Okay. So my first proof of the course. Let's let sigma be a winning strategy. For player 1. And we'll define F sigma, we'll just call it F, from 2 to the omega into 2 to the omega as follows. F of Y is the outcome of the game when one follows sigma, his strategy, which tells him how to play, and 2 plays this infinite sequence, I naught, I one, I two, equal to y. So two plays a y here, a binary sequence. One follows the strategy that determines the whole outcome of the game. And it's easy to check that f is 1-to-1 and continuous. And since sigma is a winning strategy, by definition of the game, the image of F is in A, otherwise he'd lose that round of the game. Well, you've got a one-to-one function from the Cantor, continuous function from the Cantor set into A, so A has a perfect subset. Let's let tau be a winning strategy for 2. And let's let P be a position in the game in which it is one's turn to move. Okay, so we're somewhere here, or possibly P is the empty sequence and it's one's turn to make its first move. Okay, we say, let's let x be in 2 to the omega, and we say tau rejects x at p if p is consistent, is an initial segment of x. So the binary sequence played out so far is consistent with x. For any move by 1, for any s n plus 1 played by 1, tau calls for 2 to play an in plus 1 such that t concatenated with sn plus 1 concatenated with in plus 1 is not an initial segment of x. So far, we're consistent with x, but the strategy tells 2, no matter what player 1 done on this move, you make sure you're not going to end up with x. Okay, now let's note, for any x in the set A, there is a position t such that tau rejects x at t. If not, one could win. One could always play so that tau doesn't reject and get an outcome of x. If not, one could play so the outcome is x. Thus defeating the allegedly winning strategy car. Okay, well, there's only countably every point in A gets rejected at some position. There's only countably many positions, and two points can't get rejected at the same position, so A is countable. Now let me write that. So A is countable. QED. Okay, now what this argument really shows is the gamma determinacy implies gamma sets have the perfect set property. Okay, so for example, sigma 1 5 determinacy implies sigma 1 5 sets have the perfect set property. We can do better. We can get gamma determinacy implies exist gamma sets have the perfect set property. So in other words, pi 1 n determinacy implies sigma 1 n plus 1 has the perfect set property. Pi 1 0, that's closed. Closed determinacy implies sigma 1 1 sets have the perfect set property, but this is provable in ZFC. In fact, you can prove Borel games are determined in ZFC. So in ZFC, we get that sigma 1 1 has the perfect set property. Okay, how do we get? Well, we do a trick known as unfolding the quantifier. So suppose A is the projection of B. Now we play the unfolded game. Okay, we got the same moves as before, but now we're going to make A play this witness. One wins if and only if, as before, X is concatenation of the S's and the I's. One wins if and only if XY, this Y played by 1, is in B. And now the same proof works, exactly the same proof, that the determinacy of this game implies A has the perfect set property. But notice that if this is sigma 1-1, then this is a closed game. Or if this is sigma 1-3, this is a pi 1-2 game. So just what I said up there, you can stick an extra quantifier on and get the perfect set property. Okay, now to be precise, I haven't really proved the perfect set property for all spaces. I've proved it for 2 to the omega. There are two ways to get it for general spaces. Instead of playing a finite sequence, you play a basic open neighborhood in the space. Alternatively, given the fact that any two uncountable polar spaces are Borel isomorphic, it follows from that directly, without playing any games, that if sigma 1 n sets in one space have the perfect set property, so do sigma 1 n sets in all the polar spaces. Okay, so I guess I'm done proving theorems, unless there's questions or comments. Okay, now I want to point out how determinacy axioms were used here. Determinacy axiom was used to prove regularity, to prove that pathologies produced by the axiom of choice don't exist in the context of definable sets. That's the way it's frequently used. Not always, but frequently. And that's also true when we're beginning next week, we talk about equivalence relations and dynamics. When you got an equivalence relation, there are certain types of pathological sets produced by the axiom of choice. And we're going to want to bring determinacy axioms into the picture to imply that those pathologies do not exist at the level of projective sets. That's the main use of determinacy in the theory of equivalence relations. Well, now I'm going to change the subject completely, but before I do, any questions? Okay, now for something completely different. Effective methods. And again, the reference for this is also Moscovakis. Now, the official rules and regulations of this course are that I'm allowed to assume that all of you took the two-week summer course that was held. Whether that assumption is true or false is irrelevant. That's how we operate. Okay? And in that summer course, Paul Larson discussed a branch of mathematics which is sometimes called recursion theory, sometimes called computability theory. The practitioners of the subject are currently feuding about what the proper name is. Okay, and he talked about recursive partial functions. On the integers. Okay, and the two main theorems are the Turing's enumeration theorem, that there's a universal Turing machine, or there's a universal function of two variables that simulates the one variable functions, and the SMN theorem, which allows you to compute indices. Now, when you want to apply recursion theory to polar spaces, well, this is really not the most important polar space. You'd like to apply it to uncountable polar spaces. And there's kind of two ways to go about it. One is the concept of a recursively presented polar space. And Paul discussed this, and it's also worked out in great detail in Moscovakis. Now, there's only countably many recursively presented polar spaces, so in some sense, most polar spaces are not recursively presentable. However, you'd really have to work pretty hard to come up with a counterexample. All natural examples have recursive presentations. So that's one way. Another way to bring recursion theory in, an alternative approach, as you work with finite products, of the spaces omega, omega the omega, and 2 to the omega. Now these are all recursively presented, and it's so combinatorial that you don't have to worry about what a recursive presentation is. Well, why is that good enough? That's good enough because all uncountable polar spaces are Borel isomorphic. And that was theorem something or other from last week, 1.6. So if you want to work with, say, the space of continuous functions on 0, 1 and do recursion theory, well, it's, you know, Borel isomorphic to this space, so we might as well work over here. And that's then you don't have to worry about what a recursively presented space or a recursive presentation is. Okay, so our spaces have have the canonical basis B sub n, and for these particular spaces, these are determined by finite sequences. For example, in omega to the omega, finite sequence from omega is a basic open set, everything extending that finite sequence. So a basic open set's the same thing as a finite sequence, or in a product, a pair of finite sequences. Okay, and all you need to know is that particular basis has all the properties of a basis in a recursively presented space. So if you think about that basis, you don't have to worry about recursive presentations. Now, what's an open set, or sigma 0, 1 set? Well, that's a set of the form union B F of N for some F. It's a union of a bunch of basic open sets. So now we define effectively open, or light face sigma 1, 1 set, no tilde, that's light face. It's anything of this form, the union of basic open sets Fn for some recursive F. So it's not just an arbitrary union of basic open sets, but it's a recursive one. That is, there's a computer program which enumerates the basic open sets that go into the union. Okay, and this light face and bold face notation is used throughout the subject. Light face anything is the effective analog of bold face anything. Terminology is due to John Addison. I once tried to estimate how many tildes I've had to write in my life due to John Addison. Came up with a number in five figures. Okay, now we define all the other point classes. We define their effective analogs by giving the same definition, except we start with this instead of with this. Okay, so example, boldface pi 0, 1 is complement of boldface sigma 0, 1. Okay, well, lightface pi 0, 1 is the complement of light face sigma 0, 1. So these are effectively closed. And then sigma 0, 2 is obtained like this. Well, we've got our effective analog. Light face sigma 0, 2 is obtained by taking the projection of a light phase pi 01 set. And bold phase sigma 11 are analytic sets. Here we project over the bare space, starting with closed sets in bare space or G delta sets in an arbitrary space. Here, light phase sigma 11 is obtained by projecting over a light phase pi 01 set, etc. I'm sure you can see the pattern. And what you may not see is how to effectivize Borel sets, effective countable unions. Well, you go to the tree. Remember that tree? You got a well-founded tree, and you attach Clopen sets to the nodes. Well, if the tree is recursive and the set of terminal nodes is recursive, so on, and the function is recursive. So there's a name for that, for historical reasons, hyperarithmetic. It's effectively Borel. Okay, so we effectivize all the notions from the bold phase to the light phase, from the classical theory to the effective theory. Now, bold phase classes, as the sigma and pi classes, are what are sometimes called R parameterized or bare space parameterized. In other words, this is the theorem that there's a universal set. We've got a U. Now let's talk about bare space. Universal for sigma 1 n, say, restricted to x. Now what that means is U is a sigma 1 n set, and every sigma 1 n subset of x is a vertical section above some point in U. Those are the universal sets. Okay, that was theorem 1.3 from last time. Well, light phase classes are omega parameterized. There's only countably many light phase sigma 1 n sets, so we can number them with omega. That's trivial, you can number them, but what's not trivial is that the universal set is in the right class. Okay, so let me, this is my next theorem, 2.6. Let's let light phase gamma be sigma 0 n, pi 0 n, sigma 1 n, or pi 1 n. And let's let y be a recursively presented polar space . There exists a set U, a subset of omega cross Y, such that U is in gamma, and every gamma subset of Y is a vertical section of U. This is what we mean by omega parameterized. Okay, the parameters are integers. If you want, the name of the sigma 1 n set is an integer. Demonstrate how that's done. Well, let's start with sigma 0, 1, effectively open. Um, in this space, and we'll then define U and X if and only if there exists an I, phi sub n I exists, and phi sub n I is an initial segment of X. Now what's this? Phi sub n equals the recursive partial function from omega into omega, into finite sequences from omega with index n. If you want computer program number n, but the output is finite sequences rather than just integers. Okay, so you get into this open set if it's an initial segment. If X is in, if it has an initial segment, so if this is one of the basic open sets, okay, this phi n is just enumerating the basic open sets that get into this effectively open set. And you can check that that's universal. It's got the right properties. Well, now let's try sigma 1, 1. If U, N, X, Y is universal for sigma 1, 1 like face restricted to X cross Y, then V and X, if and only if there exists a Y, U and X, Y, is universal for sigma 1, 1 restricted to X. Just project the universal set. So we get universal sets for all the sigma and pi classes, not for the delta classes, again, because you could diagonalize your way out if there was one. And we also, we have, okay, we've got a bunch of product spaces, right? And we have a universal set for each product space, but they're coherent. We have what, in the immortal terminology of Moscovakis, this is a good parametrization. It means we have recursive SMN functions. So an SMN function, suppose I take omega cross X and I take a sigma 1, 1 set with index 5 and I plug in a 7 into the first coordinate, that's a sigma 1, 1 subset of X, my function should compute its index. Yes. If U is, Thank you. Okay, now this automatically transfers because you've got the SMN theorem for these. You'll get them for this. But I just want to point out, we don't need this directly. What the SMN theorem is used for in descriptive set theory is the same thing as used for in elementary recursion theory. So what this good business means is this allows us to calculate indices. Well, what do I mean by that? Here, let me give an example. Okay, here's a theorem which I'm not going to number because it's too boring. If A and B are sigma 1, 1, light face, so is A intersect B, closed under intersection. Now, we have, to use recursion theoretic language, this holds uniformly. That means if U and X is our universal set. There is a recursive function let's call this F, such that U of Fij is the intersection of Ui and the intersection of Uj for all ij. I mean here the vertical section above I and j. Okay, so not only is it closed under intersection, but what I'm saying is if I give you an index for A and I give you another index for B with respect to this universal set, say the vertical section above I is A and above J is B, then this function will compute for me an index for the intersection. That's what's meant by uniformity, and that's what follows from the SMN theorem. This has nothing to do with intersection. It's true for any other property, closure or structural. When you've got, for every sigma 1, 1 set A, there exists a sigma 1, 1 set B, blah, that holds uniformly. There's a function, recursive function, that if I give you an index for A, the function will compute the index for B, blah. Again, this is discussed in great detail in Moskovakis. In fact, it's discussed in too much detail in Moskovakis. Okay, now, one can also relativize A is just a subset of omega, or in recursion theory terms, an oracle, then we can form sigma 0, 1 in A. You know, they're the recursive in A functions. And we can form sigma 0, 1 in A and sigma I, N in A, sigma 1, N. And boldface sigma 1, N is just the union over all A, sigma 1, N, A. So this is a refinement. This is a refinement of the classical theory. If it's sigma 1, N, that means there's some A such that it's sigma 1, N relative to A. Now, what I've been doing in so far may seem kind of scatterbrained. I've been all over the map and what I'm talking about, but there is a method to my madness, and I've got something in mind. What I want to do, of course, in the coming weeks is talk about equivalence relations and actions, and there's a particular topology which is used in the study of those equivalence relations. And most of what I've said so far has been directed toward either proving properties of the topology or other properties that we're going to need in connection with that topology. So let me at last introduce the topology. What all this was designed to discuss. So here's the definition. The Gandhi-Harrington topology on a recursively presented polar space well, being a polar space, it has a Polish topology, but it also has this, which is a different topology, okay? The Gandhi-Harrington topology is the topology whose basis is the light face sigma 1, 1 sets. That's closed under intersection, so that's evasive. And now there's two properties of this topology that we need. Well, first, the strictly topological properties. It's second countable, obviously has a countable basis, namely the sigma 1-1 sets. Strong Choquet. Well, as I pointed out last time in theorem something or other, roughly theorem 1.8, you got any countable collection of, almost every countable collection of bald-faced sigma 1-1 sets gives you a strong Choquet topology. You close it under enough, it gives you a strong Choquet topology, while the light-faced sigma 1-1 sets have enough closure properties. So they give you a strong Choquet topology and finer than the usual topology. Because the usual basic open sets are light-faced sigma 1-1. And let me again remind you, if it's strong Choquet, then the space itself and all G delta subspaces are bare spaces, so one can do bare category arguments. The second thing we need is that the basis, i.e., the light-faced sigma 1-1 sets, have a good parametrization. Okay, there are universal sets, and moreover, there's this uniformity property. We can calculate indices. Now, if all I had was part A, there would be no need for recursion theory and effective methods. It's just almost every countable collection of bald-faced sigma 1-1 sets would satisfy part A. That was last week's class. Part B seems to me essentially recursion theoretic. There is no known proof that you can get a countable collection with a universal set that doesn't go through Turing's enumeration theorem. It seems necessary to prove it, to prove there exists a universal Turing machine. And ignoring the question of proof, the smallest collection of bald-faced sigma 1-1 sets with this property is light-faced sigma 1-1. So this comes up naturally. It seems to require recursion theory, like it or not, and there's a lot of people who don't like it, but they're stuck. Okay, this is all we need. There's one more property of this topology, which will be my next theorem. We don't actually need it. In fact, it was discovered rather late in the game, long after this topology was used to prove theorems. But the next theorem that I'm going to state, while not literally necessary, makes life much easier. Now, the Gandhi-Harrington topology is not Polish or equivalently not regular. And I'm told that not regular is undesirable. Even general topologists who spend their life studying weird spaces consider not regular spaces to be undesirable. So this is very bad. But even though this is not a Polish topology and in some sense not a nice topology, it is morally equivalent to a Polish topology. And here's why. It's used in bare category arguments. And in a bare category argument, you can always throw away a meager set. Well, this topology has the property that you can throw away a meager set. Look at what's left over with the relative topology. That's Polish. Theorem 2.7. There exists Gandhi-Harrington co-meager subset of omega to omega, which is Polish. A Polish space in its relative topology. So So with these properties of the topology, next week I can actually begin studying equivalence relations. Now, theorem 2.7 is the last problem on the homework, which I'm going to hand out today. And in order to do that, you're going to have to use some of the next 72 theorems that I got to cover in the next 15 minutes, so I better get to them. But the rest of the class, I want to talk about the effective theory and how it relates to the regular classical bald-faced theory. Okay, let's start with regularity properties. It tells us nothing. If all bald-faced sigma 1-1 sets are Lebesgue measurable, then all light-faced sigma 1-1 sets are Lebesgue measurable. There's nothing there. Okay, but what about structural properties? Well, we've seen, let's consider the separation. Okay, we've got two disjoint sigma 1-1 sets can be separated by a delta 1-1 set. Well, that has an effective version. Okay, two disjoint light-faced sigma 1-1 sets can be separated by a light-faced delta 1-1 set. That means the set and its complement are both light-faced sigma 1-1. Well, you get the effective theorem from the classical theorem by erasing the tildes. And that's true for all the other theorems that I talked about. You write down any classical theorem, like last time I had the pre-well ordering property. Erase the tildes, you get an effective theory. And it's the same proof. You go through the classical proof and you erase the tildes, and you get the effective proof. Yeah, I mean, in practice, that's not a theorem, but in practice, in the real world, everything effectivizes. But from another point of view, that says this is an effective version of the classical theorem, but one might regard the classical theorem as being kind of a corollary of the effective theorem. Here's one way this is sometimes done. One frequently proves something like this. So you write a paper and you prove a theorem like this, and then you say this relativizes. Now, one never proves that. It's not done. One just says this relativizes. Okay, so two disjoint sigma 1-1a sets can be separated by a delta 1-1a set for all a. And then the classical bold-faced version is indeed a corollary of this relativized version. Okay, and in fact, there are bald-faced theorems which have no known classical proof. That is, you have to do it this way. You have to use recursion theory. Okay, but there's more to the effective theory than taking a classical result and erasing the tildes. It would not be a very interesting subject if that's all there was to it. Now, I've already mentioned the omega parametrizations, the universal sets. That's something different. Let me introduce something else which is genuinely different. It's not just an effectivized version of a classical concept. Okay, so when you've got the effective theory, one thing that's different is that the space omega, the countable discrete space, becomes interesting. Well, classically, every subset of omega is Clopin, and that's the end of it. But now there's only countably many effectively Clopin, or countably many light-faced sigma 1-1 sets. So descriptive set theory on that space is suddenly interesting. And in uncountable spaces, in, say, the reals, or omega to the omega, or 2 to the omega, points become interesting. I mean, singletons. And classically, all points are closed and none of them are open, and that's the end of the descriptive set theory of one-point sets. But they're certainly not all effectively closed. Okay, now the most interesting case, or what's known as, let's call it a delta 1-1 point, x in, let's say, omega to the omega, are also effectively Borelli, hyper-arithmetic point, same thing, or a hype point for short. Now, there's a number of ways to define this, and they're all equivalent. One is that singleton x is delta 1-1 light phase. In other words, this point set, this one-point point set, is both sigma 1-1 and pi 1-1. It's equivalent to saying that this is a sigma 1-1 singleton. It's equivalent to saying that x as a function is a delta 1-1 subset of omega squared, as the graph of the function is delta 1-1. Any reasonable way of defining a delta 1-1 point is gives you the same meaning, same points. And what are they good for? Well, earlier today I stated and more or less proved the perfect set theorem. A bold-faced sigma 1-1 set is either countable or has a perfect subset. Well, trivially, that's true for light phase. But you get a stronger theorem, which is known as the effective perfect set theorem. And my numbering is 2-8. No, yeah, 2-8. Okay, if a set A is light phase sigma 1-1, either A has a perfect subset, or, now the original perfect set theorem says, or A is countable. But now we know something more. We can tell you what those countably many points are. Or all members of A are delta 1-1 points. So if it's countable, all the points are very simply definable. Now that is not an effective analog of a classical theorem. That's something really different. It has no classical analog. And that can be proved by a game similar to the one used to prove the perfect set theorem, but you've got to know that the certain strategy is hyperarithmetic, is delta 1-1. Okay, theorem 2.9, pi 1-1, I'll say light phase, is closed under quantification of the form. There exists a delta 1-1 point. That is, if AX, Y is pi 1-1, and BX is defined to say there is a delta 1-1 point. Oops, did I do this backwards? BY there exists a delta 1-1 with an oracle for Y point. A then B is pi 1 1. This is very useful because at first glance it assumes it looks like that's an existential quantifier over the reals, but you're really only quantifying over the integers because countably many pi delta 1 1 reals, and saying something is a delta 1 1 real is pi 1 1. And from theorem 2.9, you can deduce that this is pi 1 1, what I talked about at the beginning of class when correcting my own mistake. Why? Because if it's unique, it's hyperarithmetic. Well, yeah, this is Borel, not if this was light phase delta 1-1, then this would be light phase. But like every other theorem, that has two versions and they're both true. Okay, it's almost over. Now, I want to talk about ordinal codes. So we have a point set, which I'll call WO, a subset of the Cantor set. These are the ordinal codes. So I can identify a point X with, well, basically the characteristic function of a binary relation with a binary relation less than or equal to x on omega. Less than or equal to x is all nm such in omega squared, such that x of the pair nm is 1. And that binary relation may or may not be a well ordering. If it is, then we'll put it in this set. Well, WO. Okay, so it's a linear ordering, and there does not exist a descending chain, so that means it's pi 1 1, saying it's light phase. If there was there exists a descending sequence, that's an existential quantifier that makes it sigma 1 1. So that's a very important pi 1 1 set. And here's something new, which is also not an analog of a classical notion. So if alpha is a countable ordinal, we say alpha is a recursive ordinal if there is a recursive sorry, I should have said if X is an ordinal code, absolute value of X denotes the ordinal. Okay, alpha, if there is a recursive X with X equals 2 to the, which is that ordinal. So there's a subset of omega squared, which is a well ordering of order type alpha, and it's recursive. One could also define delta 1, 1 ordinals. And in fact, delta 1, 1 ordinals are recursive ordinals. That does not mean that a delta 1 1 well ordering is necessarily recursive, but it means there's another recursive well ordering of the same length. Now, there's only countably many delta 1-1 or countably many recursive points, so there's only countably many recursive ordinals. And these obviously form an initial segment. Why is it obvious? You've got a recursive ordinal, and you take a point and look at everything below that, that's still recursive. So it's a countable initial segment of omega 1. Now this, again, is something different. It's not a light face analog of an effective notion. Classically, you know, there's just ordinals. There's not two kinds of ordinals. Now we've got two kinds, the delta 1-1 or recursive ordinals and the non-delta 1-1. So, omega 1 ck is the least non-recursive ordinal, or the least non-delta 1-1 ordinal. Ck stands for Church-Kleiny, not for Calvin Klein. And omega 1 x is the least non-recursive in x ordinal. So, in other words, omega 1 ck is omega 1 of something like that. It's a kind of effective analog of Aleph 1. Now, on the homework, you're asked to prove, on the homework which I'll hand out when I'm done talking, which should be about 5 minutes, every non-empty, effectively closed subset of 2 to the omega has a delta 1-1 element. Okay, this is false for omega to the omega. So in other words, a closed set's a tree, right? So every recursive tree, not necessarily well-founded, but every recursive tree on 2 has a hyperarithmetic branch, but it's not the case that every recursive tree on omega has an hyperarithmetic branch. So we can't claim that just because something is simple, is easy to define, it has a hyperarithmetic real. Okay, so there are pi 0 1 effectively closed subsets of omega to the omega, and therefore effectively g delta subsets of the reals, which contain no hyperarithmetic points. Nevertheless, while a simply defined set does not necessarily have a delta 1 1 point, it has a point which is recursion theoretically simple in another sense. And that's theorem 2.11, second last theorem today. For historical reasons, this is called the Gandhi basis theorem. The word basis has nothing to do with vector spaces. Okay, any non-empty light face sigma 1-1 set contains a point x such that omega 1 x is equal to omega 1 ck. I skipped 210, didn't I? We'll come back to that. Okay, we'll get back to that. Two more theorems. What does it mean that this real or this point is simple? Well, it's not delta 1-1, but it doesn't contain enough information to compute this ordinal. It somehow contains no information, or it's relatively uninformative. It tells you nothing about ordinals. In that sense, it contains a point which is recursion theoretically simple. And that's false for pi 1-1. Back to theorem 2.10.